Tonight, I could stay all night. knows what to do. She looks through her hair like she doesn't care. What she does best is stand and stare. She can play the drums in two, and the boys say, hey, do what you do. My friend P just says, he you. My friend P just says, he you. I know a secret or two about you. She won't mind if I tell you. She likes to wear green underwear and lays down most anywhere. She doesn't have nothing to do, and the boys say, hey, do what you do. My friend, he goes, he, you. My friend, he goes,
faces on the wall. And that's alright with me. I see you run to make a call. But won't that be someone free? Your life and my life, they don't touch at all. That's no way to be. Never seen so far.
Chapter 24. Evol, Shadow of a Doubt. The way the band composed songs was pretty much always the same. Thurston or Lee would usually sing the poppy, more melodic things from riffs Thurston or Lee wrote. I sang the weirder, more abstract things that came out of all of us playing together and rearranging until everything gelled. My voice has always had a fairly limited range, and when you're writing a melody, you tend to write it for your own voice. Lee, on the other hand, usually brought in songs that were complete and ready to go, then we layered dissonance over. Over the years, Thurston and I always agreed on aesthetic things. We agreed about record covers pretty much all the time. For the most part, we also agreed about mixes. If and when they took place, our fights mostly centered around how he treated or spoke to me. In the band's early days, our first drummer, Richard Edson, was the first to notice the dynamic between us. He would stand up for me saying things like, "Hey man, there's no call to talk to her like that." Lee never said a word. Whenever Thurston spoke to me sharply or bluntly, it seemed to make him uncomfortable, and it was probably hard for Lee and Steve to figure out the boundaries of where Thurston and I started as a couple and stopped as bandmates. I was allergic to making scenes and did everything possible to maintain an identity as an individual within the band. I had no interest in being just the female half of a couple. When we were starting out, I was very sensitive, a hangover from my relationship with Keller, and let Thurston take the lead in most things. In the months leading up to our split, it was gratifying to me when Thurston, listening to some old live recordings of ours, remarked, "Wow, he were playing some amazing things." Gratifying, but also strange to hear, as in our early days playing live, I had no technical ability to speak of, no knowledge of conventional chording. At the same time, I was always confident in my ability to contribute something good to our sound in at least an unconventional or minimalist way. A musicality, a sense of rhythm. All the no-wave bands, the jazz I'd listened to growing up, and the improv Keller and I had done back in our childhood living room came back to me on stage, blurring with the rock and roll riff or theater Thurston always wanted to convey. From the beginning, music for me was visceral. I loved playing music. When it was going well, it was an almost ecstatic experience. What could be better than sharing that feeling of transcendence with the man I was so close to in all other areas of my life, someone who was having the same experience? It was a feeling impossible to communicate with someone outside of the two of us. I wanted deliverance, the loss of myself, the capacity to be inside that music. It was the same power and sensation you feel when a wave takes you up and pushes you somewhere else. Thurston and I first met Raymond Pettibone in the early 80s during a trip to L.A., where I was visiting my parents. Someone told us about a house party in Hermosa Beach where Black Flag was playing. So we drove down to South Bay, pulling up in front of a typical single-level house. The neighborhood was languid, slightly funky, as if it had tried and failed to become a beach resort, morphing instead into a shabby suburban neighborhood, a walk away from the ocean. The house was small, the music ferocious. Henry Rollins in the kitchen, in full force, dressed in those signature small black shorts that I believe were technically an old-style nylon bathing suit. Slick with sweat, he was writhing around, bumping into cabinets and people, at one point coming up to me and singing straight into my face. Coming from the New York downtown scene, where people had no houses or garages, and thus no house parties, this was a completely new scene for us. The Black Flag Show was one of the best gigs I'd ever seen before or since. Scary, surreal, intimate. As the sound crashed and bounced off the refrigerator counter and shelves, and Henry Rollins twerked years before twerking existed, the performance fused hardcore punk with suburban sunlit banality, high theater with the everyday erasing any and all boundaries between band and audience. At one point, Thurston and I went out into the glare of the backyard, where Mike Watt from the Minutemen introduced us to Raymond Pettibone. To us, Raymond was already a semi-mythical figure, as a couple of years back we had become keenly interested in his zines. Raymond was shy, casually disheveled, altogether normal-looking. Still, it felt unbelievable to be hanging out with Mike and Raymond and other musicians and bands whose records we owned. The L.A. scene. At that point in the mid-80s, Ray had no relationship to the art world and had never had a gallery show. At the time, he was known exclusively for his SST covers. Later that same year, I wrote an article for Artform about Raymond's work, as well as Mike Kelly's and Tony Osler's. How the three of them eschewed the conceptual mantle of 70s formalism and mixed high and low culture. Soon afterwards, Raymond began showing at the Ace Gallery in L.A. Like a flower, he slowly opened up. The only thing he needed was just a little attention. That day sticks out so much in my mind, not just because it was the first time I met Raymond, but because seeing Henry Rollins inspired the song Halloween. Even after Bad Moon, I never felt like I had a place in the New York music scene. Artists I had no trouble conversing with, but I had no idea how to talk to musicians. I felt confused about how I should look, and I felt frumpy and nerdy a lot of the time. I also had no confidence, really. I don't think artists ever feel like what they do is enough. And even though I was now part of a musical couple, I wasn't doing as much as I thought I should be doing individually. My art career was kind of on hold. And without confidence, it doesn't matter what you're wearing. I once interviewed Raymond Pettibone, who spoke about having to dumb himself down whenever he talked to musicians. Not that musicians are unintelligent, he said. They just don't intellectualize in the same way artists do. Criticize something in front of musicians and they'll take it personally. Criticize artists and they're more likely to take it intellectually. It's just different, that's all. We weren't remotely a goth band, but Evol was our faux goth record, the one that contains Expressway to Your Skull, Sonic Youth's first so-called long song. Evol was also the first record we put out on the indie record label SST. SST, who put out records by Black Flag, Minutemen, Husker Du, and the Meat Puppets, was ideal for us. The name Evol came from an art video that my friend Tony Osler made, while the cover was a film still created by filmmaker Richard Kern. Richard's faux horror films were dark, funny, and voyeuristic, typically shot from a height with tongue-in-cheek gore. The song Shadow of a Doubt came from an Alfred Hitchcock film. What I'm reading at the time tends to influence and inform what I'm working on, whether it's a novel or a Hitchcock bio. I tend to write lyrics with a sense of space around them, one-liners almost, short sentences containing pauses that build tension along with the music, as if I'm awaiting some big drama or crash to occur, though it never does. The song just ends. I was always a big fan of early songs by the Shangri-Las, with their whispered, almost spoken word approach leading up to a violent climax, such as in Leader of the Pack, or I Can Never Go Home Anymore. In Shadow of a Doubt, I was trying to describe the connection you feel when your eyes meet another person's. You project all kinds of things on those eyes, feel them seeing into and past you, sometimes feel the sex behind them too. The song imagines what would happen if you acted on that feeling, with things devolving into a scene from a pulpy film noir novel, and nothing you did could stop the inevitable. A young filmmaker named Kevin Kerslake made a video for Shadow of a Doubt, the first one we ever did that had the look and feel of something that could play on MTV. We had made videos before, notably for Death Valley 69. For that song, in fact, there were two different videos, one more arty, one more hardcore. In the hardcore video for Death Valley 69, I remember lying on the ground with blood everywhere, our fake guts spilling from our stomachs, while off camera, Lee's wife Amanda was having actual labor contractions. A vivid contrast between fake death and incoming life. In the video, I also got to wield a shotgun. Girls with guns, girls in control, girls as revolutionaries, girls acting out. Why is that such a perennial turn-on to people? Eva also had a cover of Kim Fowley's Bubblegum, as well as songs like Star Power and, of course, Expressway to Your Skull, which contained what, to my mind, were Thurston's best lyrics. We're gonna kill the California girls, meaning we're from New York and we're not pop or rock and we're coming to get you. We're coming to California. We did Expressway in one take, and I remember sitting in the dark studio with Thurston, Lee, and Steve listening back to it. It was absolutely thrilling. Those were the moments I felt closest to Thurston, when I felt that together he and I had created something special, music that would go out into the world and take on its own life. No matter what happened to that music, I was convinced it was good and would last forever. When I listen to Evol today, I'm amazed by the amount of reverb on it. I had so little perspective back then, on everything. When Sonic Youth toured England, journalists took to asking me a single question over and over. What's it like to be a girl in a band? I'd never really thought about it, to be honest. The mostly male English music press was cowardly and non-confrontational in person. They would then go home and write cruel, ageist, sexist things. I'd always assumed it was because they were terrified of women. The whole country had a queen complex, after all. I might have been projecting my own discomfort at acting out a pre-written role onto these writers, but I refused to play the game. I didn't want to dress like Susie or Lydia Lunch, or to act out the role of an imaginary female, someone who had more to do with them than with me. That just wasn't who I was. For that reason, I found the British band, The Raincoats, both cool and inspirational. They were an all-girl post-punk band, playing non-commercial music, rhythmic and off-kilter. They came across as ordinary people playing extraordinary music. They didn't use typical instrumentation, either. After their drummer, Paul Molliv, left, the experimental rock drummer Charlie Hayward joined them on drums, adding to a sound that included the violin and a bunch of exotic second-hand instruments from Africa and Bali, like the balafon and the kalimba and the gamelan. Here were women playing and singing against every stereotype there was, but doing it subtly and musically, gently and mystically, without the traditional aggression of rock and punk, and without flying a freak flag. I'd spent my entire life never doing what was easy, never doing what was expected. I had no idea what image I projected on stage or off, but I was willing to let myself be unknown forever. Self-consciousness was the beginning of creative death to me. I felt at ease only when I'd recorded something I felt good about, or was in the middle of a gig and the sound swirling from the stage was so amazing that time stopped and I could feel the audience in the dark breathing as a single unit. That is all a fantasy, yes, but everyone needs to pretend. As Jay Maskus of Dinosaur Jr. liked to say when asked about being in a band, it's not fun, it's not about having fun.
Thank you. Yeah.
first time Thurston and I ever saw Nirvana was at the famous music venue Maxwell's in Hoboken, New Jersey. Bruce Pavitt, who founded the record label Sub Pop, told me that if I liked Mudhoney, which I did, that I'd love Nirvana. He added, "You have to see them live. Kurt Cobain is like Jesus. People love him. He practically walks on the audience." Bruce had started Sub Pop as a cassette subscription service before moving on to 7-inch singles, including Nirvana's, which was called Love Buzz. Sonic Youth had done a split single with Mudhoney, covering their Touch Me, I'm Sick, while Mudhoney covered our song, Halloween. Thurston and I had both heard Love Buzz, and our friend Suzanne had done the artwork for it. Nirvana was already popular in Seattle, and we were curious to see what they were all about. Nirvana was a great live band, and Thurston and I, like everybody else in the world, immediately responded to the mixture of good melodies and dissonance. Nirvana seemed part hardcore, part Stooges, but with a cheesy chorus pedal effect that was more new wave than punk. No one else could use that chorus pedal, which gives the shimmer effect you hear on the guitar in the intro to Come As You Are, for example, and still be punk rock. As a performer, Kurt Cobain was both incredibly charismatic and extremely conflicted. One minute he would be playing a pretty melody, and the next he'd be trashing all the equipment. Personally, I like when things fall apart. That's real entertainment. Deconstructed. Maxwell's could be sleepy during the week, and there weren't a lot of people in attendance the night we showed up, maybe 10 to 15. Aside from Kurt, Nirvana had a second guitar player, and I knew from Bruce that Kurt wasn't that happy with him. You could tell the band wasn't having the best gig, but it was also obvious something interesting was going on. The next night we went to see them again at the Pyramid Club in the East Village. The club was practically full. I was surprised to run into Iggy Pop, but I guess he wanted to see what all the hype was about too. Kurt ended up trashing the drums and almost managed to knock an amp down the spiral stairs on the stage leading to the dressing room below. Thurston and I both agreed it was an amazing show. Iggy, I remember, wasn't quite as impressed. We later went backstage. Kurt told us that he'd just fired his guitar player and his drummer. Standing in front of me, Kurt seemed small, close to my height, though he was actually 5'9" and I'm only 5'5". He had big watery eyes, slightly hunted looking. I'm not sure why, but I felt an immediate kinship with him. One of those mutual, I can tell you are a super sensitive and emotional person too, sorts of connections. Thurston didn't seem to have the same thing going with Kurt, but he'd be the first to say Kurt and I had some sort of good, inexplicable connection. We weren't close the way he was to Kathleen Hanna of Bikini Kill, or Toby Vail, who was his girlfriend, or any of his male friends that he grew up with. I didn't know Kurt all that well, two tours worth, but our friendship was unusual. On stage, it was amazing to see how much emotional power came from the depths of his body, a gravelly stream of vocal sound. It wasn't screaming or shrieking or even punk vitriol, although that's what it sounded like the most. There were also quiet parts, low, moanish, when you'd half believe Kurt's voice was hoarse, and then he'd throw himself on the drum set, which in his anger and frustration he seemed to want to annihilate. He seemed always to be working against himself. In contrast to Kurt, who was so physically small, Chris, Nirvana's bass player, was enormous. He was also seemingly unfazed by whatever played out on stage. Chris, who I'll always remember hurling his bass up into the air and never once getting clobbered, except at the MTV Video Music Awards, or damaging his instrument. Kurt, who played left-handed, wrecked so many guitars that he ended up forced to play a lot of regular right-hand ones. But his destructiveness was different from when Pete Townsend or Jimi Hendrix smashed his guitar. Kurt was vulnerable where they weren't, mixed in with an edge of enormous explosiveness and a desire to say and connect more with the audience beyond music. When Nirvana toured with us in 1991, before Nevermind broke, no one in Europe knew who they were. They were often the first band on stage at festivals, playing amazing shows filmed by Dave Markey, the filmmaker who came along with us to document the tour that later became the film 1991, the year punk broke. The movie had a lot of humorous moments of over-the-top self-indulgence. It was basically a spoof of rockumentaries. Kurt was always funny and fun to be around, and seemed to soak up any kind of personal attention. I felt very big-sisterly, almost maternal whenever the two of us were together, and it shows in that film. Later, soon after Kurt and Courtney got together and had their baby, Frances Bean, we were playing in Seattle, and the two of them came to see us. After the show, Kurt cornered me in the dressing room. "I don't know what to do," he said. "Courtney thinks Frances likes me more than her." Someone took a photo of us right at that moment. My back is turned to the camera, and I remember that conversation vividly, so telling in so many ways. The first being that Kurt had no one he felt comfortable asking for advice. The second being that, yes, Courtney was utterly self-absorbed. And finally, that Kurt probably did spend more time with Frances than Courtney did. Looking back, I can't imagine what life was like in the chaos of their drug-fueled life, and it's hard for me to remember that they were together for only a couple of years. It takes so little time to forge a life, or in this case, a brand.
Hello, this is Cleo, and you're listening to WGXC 90.7 FM Accra.